Anne Lamott is famous for her intensely personal and very funny style of writing. The personal embarrassments that most of us try to stuff in the closet, she splashes all over her pages. Like her history as a drunk and drug addict. And her feelings of shame and inadequacy. So when Lamott writes about finding God, well, let's just say it's not your normal spiritual memoir. Anne Strangechamps recently sat down with Anne Lamott to talk about her latest book. It's called Grace, Eventually.
I was raised by atheists, and not just regular plain old atheists, but my father had been born and raised in Tokyo with Presbyterian missionary parents, and it was a pretty cold household, and so he's always called the Presbyterians God's frozen people, and of all Christians, I think hated them most.
Isn't that what you are?
One of God, yeah, I'm a Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, not a frozen person.
But if you came to our church, it's like it's hilariously warm and sweet and dear and freeform. It's like freeform skating. It's really not heavy doctrinal. It's really about goodness and mercy and service. But I was raised without any training or any problems, really. I was allowed to go to churches and Christian Science services and temple with my friends because I always sought out friends whose family had faith, but no.
So from the time you were little, were you curious about faith?
You know, I remember one of my best friends was named Peggy when I was 6 years old, and they were Catholics. They lived right down the street, and they had hundreds and hundreds of children, and Peggy was my friend. And I remember, first of all, I remember her very, very devout Catholic father just beating her while I was lying in bed with her. We're six-year-old girls, because she had done something in the kitchen that displeased him. Like, hadn't thrown out the apple peels. I remember exactly. Hadn't thrown out the apple peels for a pie we had helped make. But I loved going to church with them. And I went a lot of Sundays because I love the ritual. I love the incense. I love the words of sweetness and peace. And the Jesus part didn't really throw me. I just wanted to know more. Then later after that, I'd gone to college, not for very long, at Goucher in Maryland. I'd had a really defining experience that I wrote about in Traveling Mercies when my professor, Eva Gossman, took us through Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, the point of the essay being you were just not going to know this side of the grave, whether there was a God or not. And it was the story of Abraham making the leap of faith when he's been asked to take beautiful, precious Isaac up onto the mountain and sacrifice him. And Isaac is saying, where are we going? Where are we going? And he's saying, Abraham's saying, we're going to sacrifice a lamb because he's made the leap of faith and he's decided to follow God no matter what, since he and Isaac are so doomed if there's no God. And of course, when they get to the mountain, there are lambs in the thicket and the angels tell Abraham, you have done a beautiful thing in your faith and trust. Now, I've got to say—
But do you like that story?
No,
I hate that story.
I really have to say—
That's one of the reasons I would agree. How can you worship a God like that?
I would agree that I hate the story, but I love the Kierkegaard take on it. I have nothing but problems with the Old Testament. All I can say is that when Eva Gossman took me through the very profound and weird and quirky Kierkegaard take on it, I made a decision to do the leap of faith and to just cross over and become a person, a seeker. Hmm. So I was 18.
You have a lovely essay in your new book, Grace, Eventually. You must have been a very young woman and having a kind of rough summer and spending one whole afternoon reading some essays by Ram Dass. And
yeah.
It sounds like that was another moment of awakening.
Well, it's sort of a funny story because it happened to be just a horrendous Sunday when I had this man I loved and he loved me, but he also loved this other woman and she had everything I didn't have, but like enormous breasts and a pretty name and she wasn't a falling down drunk and drug addict, which I thought gave her an unfair advantage over me. And also I loved him more than she did. So that was another like...
Count against you.
So I had, when we had gone to bed the night I spent with him, we hadn't seen each other for months. And then things with his other girlfriend had cooled and we were back together and we'd had a perfect night. And I saw this book by a guy I'd never heard of, Ram Dass, who turned out to be Richard Alpert, who did the LSD experiments at Harvard with Tim Leary, who I consider a truly dangerous person on this funny blue marble we live on. But anyway, Ram Dass wasn't. He was a gentle, very neurotic, very Jewish Boston Brahmin and had gone to India to seek enlightenment and had found a beautiful teacher named Karoli Baba. So there were these essays from the Menninger Foundation. I just picked them up when I couldn't sleep, and it turned out that she, my competitor, had given them to him, and she signed it, and she'd even drawn this little drawing of Krishna, like, bore me later. Like, what can you say in the face of that? So I put the book down with contempt. And then in the morning, I so wanted to be with him. And it turned out he was going to go to a beautiful outdoor luncheon at the house she owned. And I mean, I literally lived on air. I was a writer. I taught tennis and cleaned houses. And I was so less than, and I so compared my insides with her outsides and really came up short. And I pretended I was sick so I could stay there. And he said, you can stay here, but I won't be back today. And I was so lost, that when he left, I just was crying. And I finally picked up this book, and it was like someone had thrown the switch on. And I started to read it, and I said, uh-oh, my God. Because what I felt like was, me too. Someone is as nuts and sensitive and neurotic and smart and screwed up as I am. And he's found this way of understanding God and human consciousness and suffering and spirituality in a way. He's talking for me. That was when the plates of the earth shifted beneath me and I could be in, because somebody else as wild as me was in.
Why do you think it is that so many of those transcendent moments when we, you know, feel, how did you write about it, the hole in the cocoon, with those moments of awakening, why is it that those only seem to happen when we're, you know, on our knees? I mean, when something really terrible is also going on, when we feel as bad as it seems possible to feel?
Well, St. John the Divine, of course, writes about the dark night of the soul. And I think it's because when we really hit some kind of a bottom, like people in recovery would understand, when you're deteriorating faster than you can lower your standards, and you've completely run out of good ideas on how to proceed, something happens, which is that we tumble or fall into the abyss that many of us have spent our entire lives avoiding. And finally, you can't go on anymore. You become, you know, it's like a Samuel Beckett character where you're there when you're pawing through your purse looking for something of meaning, and that's when you fall in the abyss. Well, the American tradition is to trick out the abyss more nicely, maybe buy some cuter curtains from IKEA and a rug from Cost Plus, and try to make it seem like it's not all that bad. But if you're lucky and you hit hard enough, you don't even have the energy, and in my case, the money, to go to IKEA for the curtains. And, you know, they call it an abyss for a reason. It's abysmal. It's dark, and it's often cold, and it's scary. And in that time, I think you finally surrender.
There's a tension in, well, especially in Christianity, I think, because there's this notion of suffering and that grace comes out of suffering. Can't that so easily turn into a great
martyrdom? Yeah, and fundamentalism and Shiite madness. Well, yeah, I mean, and I always have said that you can tell you've created God in your own image when he hates all the same people you do. And I think that's what happens, you know, and I think that it's the scariest thing of all is, you know, the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. I think it's the scariest position to be in, is to be sure that you're right.
How did Jesus come into your life?
Well, this was an accident, I want to say. I was drinking, and over-serving myself on a daily basis and taking pills to help me with either the exhaustion or the mania. And I used to go over to the flea market in my little community, and I would hear the music wafting over from this crummy-looking little church. Talk about Beckett. It looked like, I mean, it had that little tree that we see at the end of Waiting for Godot, where the grace is represented by three leaves on the trees that hadn't been there when the play opens. They're like three leaves on the tree, and I like that in a church. I like ramshackle and buckle and sag, because it seems like it might be a place that would be glad that I was there. I wasn't hearing gospel. What I was hearing was basically the soundtrack of the civil rights movement, and the soundtrack of all those peace marches I went to as a teenager when we were in Vietnam and Cambodia, all the songs Pete Seeger and Joan Baez and Mahalia Jackson had sung. I just went in because I had run out of good ideas, and there weren't very many people there, maybe 40, and they didn't even have pews. I just sat down because I liked the music, and then they did the most important thing I think you can offer people who are lost, which is they didn't hassle me to death. They didn't come up and want to come visit me, which, have, believe me, I would have run screaming for my cute little life if they had tried to sign me up or for Bible study or help me understand doctrine, the, you know, the triune nature of God. Or,
but where, and so, where did Jesus come in?
Well, so they're Christians, so they were talking about Jesus as the person from whom they heard this, from whom they heard that they were supposed to ease the suffering, and that they, Jesus doesn't mention sex, for instance. There's nothing about sex. There's nothing about gays. There's nothing about not being married, you know, living with somebody you love. There's not any information about who you are allowed to love or be loved by. So they were talking about what Jesus tell us, which is feed my sheep, you know, take care of the hungry, that Jesus will be where the least of his people are, that if you want to be with Jesus, go hang out with the desperately poor. You want to feel his love, go to the prisons. He'd been a prisoner. Go sit down with the prisoners. You know, that they are, the least of his people are so precious to him, and he will be especially close to them. And I heard that. I often left for the sermon in my first year because the Jesus part was definitely a fly in the ointment for me, you know. I mean, even though these people were Christians, but I heard something, you know. I heard something so deep under the rubble that I thought was dead. And so after a year, for some reason that I will never explain, I said, okay, whatever, I'm in. And I got sober a year later after that. So I converted drunk. Mm-hmm. And people can say whatever they want about that. But I know that I experienced Jesus as sort of a funny little presence, like a little feral kitten or something running by my feet. And I didn't want a little kitten at the time. And I'm not stupid. I know that if you feed them or even pet them, you suddenly have a feral little kitten. And finally, one day, at the very, very bottom of my cycle of my life, I said, okay, you can come in. And I said to Jesus, fine, whatever. But it was mostly that the people there let me be and let me find my way. And for some reason, the people at that little church and the preachers at that little church and the music we sing and the service that those people do spoke to me.
Anne Lamott talked with Anne Strangechamps. Lamott's latest book is called Grace Eventually, Thoughts on Faith.